conversation with someone when they have that revelation, like the interview.
It's making sure.
How does this work as a national story?
Well, it's opens San Francisco.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Ballots came today. Huh.
What?
They changed our polling place.
Of course they did. They want to make it harder for us to find them. That is the reason I don't vote in the first place.
You're kidding, right? You vote. You have to vote. Of course you vote.
Kenya Barris is the creator of the series Black-ish on ABC. And over the summer, Barris got deeply frustrated with some of the questions he's been getting. And he told a reporter, I'm so tired of talking about diversity. We'll find out what he meant later in the show. But right now, there are two big contests taking place in America, the presidential election and the playoffs. And if you live in Chicago, you're excused for going, the presidential
second
what?
One out, Addison Russell, the batter. And a high fly ball, deep left field, that is gone!
For the first time in 250 years, the Chicago Cubs have a shot at the World Series. Okay, it's 108, but whatever. We're going to talk about both of these contests, the election and the World Series, with a guy who's uniquely qualified to do that. David Axelrod has been a political strategist for decades. He's best known as the chief strategist of Barack Obama's campaign and served as a senior advisor in the White House after his election. And Axelrod just made his debut, this might be more important, as a New Yorker contributor with a profile of the Chicago Cubs general manager, Theo Epstein. David, let's talk about first things first, the most important thing in your life now. You are the Chicago Cubs correspondent for NewYorker.com.
Yes, and proud to be.
And thank you for that. Are the Cubs going all the way? That's all I want to know.
You know, when I talked to Theo Epstein in the spring, and I had this long conversation with him that was just a tutorial on baseball, he said, you know, all you can do is build a team that will get to the playoffs almost every year. And one of those years, you're going to win the World Series. It feels like this is the year. And I hope it is because they're pitching. They've got a great pitching staff. But, you know, Chicagoans have been trained over 108 barren years to be a little bit like, a little bit skeptical.
But you know, you don't get to have that anymore. That gets erased. It's like Bostonians,
right?
After they won the series, I didn't want to hear about it from them anymore.
Well, I think that's fair.
So, David, there's this other contest going on, apparently, a presidential one. And you've written this. Barbaric and sometimes ridiculous as this process of running for president can be, the thing that I love about it is that at the end of the day, you can't hide who you are.
Yes.
What are you finding out about Hillary Clinton that you didn't know already?
You know, I knew Hillary Clinton very well. I mean, I worked for her when she ran for the Senate in 2000. I worked against her when I worked for Barack Obama in 2008. And then I worked with her when she was Secretary of State. And I've seen everything that that I know about her. She's tenacious. She's smart. She's incredibly guarded.
You wrote a pretty angry tweet that I can't imagine the Clinton campaign was too thrilled about her health scare when
right.
She had pneumonia briefly.
Yes. I was upset because, you know, her problem with voters is not health, it's stealth. It's this notion that she is not revealing enough, and to try and hide the fact that she was ill and for 6 hours not disclose what the situation was, I thought was foolish and reckless in the midst of a campaign in which this was clearly the issue. You know, and I know exactly what happened. She was being goaded by Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani about her
stamina
health.
And
yeah, which is ridiculous because Hillary Clinton, as we saw in the debate, I mean, Donald Trump was spent by the end of that debate, and she was as game as could be. She is a tenacious and indefatigable person.
What do you think a second debate is going to bring out in Donald Trump? Clearly, he has to know at some level, even Donald Trump with his capacity for denial and enormous ego and all the rest, he has to know, and he's been told, that he lost. And that he ran out of gas, and that he was erratic, and all the rest in the second.
Well, debate. and that he paid a price for not preparing. I mean, you know, I had concluded going into the first debate that he will either emerge as the most talented politician in American history, or he'll pay the price for not prepping. Because in my experience, you cannot go into as pressure-filled an event as a presidential debate in the finals and not have prepared for it. Part of the lesson, you know, his people say, well, you know, he's not like one to dive into briefing books and stuff. Well, you know what? I got news for him. When you're president, you kind of have to do that.
And he goes with his gut.
The problem he has is, I mean, first of all, he is reacting a little bit like I expected that he would, because after the conventions, when she had such a good convention and he was attacked in ways that obviously provoked him, he went into this tailspin, you know, sort of paroxysms of, you know, invective against the cons and everyone else. And, you know, he's sort of come out of this a little bit like that. He's on the attack.
And yet for the 6 weeks prior to the debate, he was on an incredible
because
road,
after
narrowing
that
after
that tailspin, he changed his management and he made some changes, the biggest of which was that he started making speeches off of teleprompters, something that he hadn't done before. His people told me before the debate, well, this was going to help him in the debate because he doesn't really, you know, review stuff that well, but the speeches he paid attention to, so maybe he would absorb that. This next debate is a town hall debate. You're going to have a theater full of citizens who are there to interact with the candidate and ask questions.
How does that change the dynamic?
Very much, because these people are going to, and the audience, the television audience, are going to recoil if instead of addressing the people there about their problems, he goes on the attack about, you know, Bill Clinton's infidelities.
Is that a bad idea?
To go after the infidelity? I think it is. I mean, I understand the theory behind it is that he's going to go after her for her treatment of the women involved.
Yeah.
But I think that she can very easily flip that. You know, everybody knows she went through a really difficult time, and she did, after all, fight to keep her marriage together.
Which is not uncommon.
Right.
As a characteristic of many people's marriages.
But it is uncommon for Donald Trump.
Now, I think I can imagine, I don't want to presume anything about our audience, but I have to imagine that a lot of public radio listeners still can't quite figure out how this happened. How Donald Trump, who had been a kind of figure on the New York jokescape in the 80s, a guy who almost played a cartoon role made for Spy magazine, made for then Jon Stewart, who seemed to be in on the joke of himself as a means of making money, suddenly turns around, surprises the commentariat by...
And maybe himself.
And maybe himself by running for president. Now he is within spitting distance of the nuclear codes.
Yes.
How did this happen, David?
Well, I think the fact that so many of your listeners are surprised by it speaks to something, which is that we have a great chasm in our country. Here in New York City, there are a lot of winners. In other places, there are a lot of people who didn't win, who saw jobs that paid a good middle-class wage.
But these are trends.
Disappear.
In fairness, these are trends that have been going on for quite a long time.
And this has been building for quite a long time. I mean, remember, Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992 talking about the forgotten middle class. You know, I think it's built over time. I think there are other elements. E.J. Dionne wrote a book about the conservative movement recently, and he said, you know, part of it was that the conservatives kept promising people that, you know, we're going to turn back Obamacare, and none of it happened. And so this radicalized the right against their own. I will say this. I was around in 2008 when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential nominee. And I remember John McCain confronting people at his own rally in Minnesota. I think it was the high point of his campaign. It was incredibly
A woman would come up and say,
I'm scared. Yeah. He's not an American. He's a Muslim.
And he'd say, wait a minute.
Right. He said, no, he's a fine person.
And
I just have disagreements with him. I thought that was John McCain's finest moment, and I'll always remember it. But the point is, the people who showed up at that rally, at those rallies, are the people who are now, you know, the core of Donald Trump's support. And he is a genius at surfing their alienation. You know, the wall, the Muslim ban. You know, you have trouble. And it's because of them, and we're going to stop it.
But isn't it amazing that this is rhetoric coming from a Manhattan real estate guy?
Yeah, but a Manhattan real estate guy who's been in the homes of Middle America for 14 years as host of The Apprentice, where he is portrayed as the omniscient, you know, businessman who knows how to run things, because that's the other element of it. So I wrote a column for The Times earlier this year about the fact that I believe that there is a replica remedy kind of dynamic in succession elections for president, where the president who's leaving sets the tone, and people never choose the replica of what they have, even if the president's popular. They always choose the remedy.
That's her biggest problem, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But
she's
seen as more of the same.
Well, that's true in the sense I'm talking in these nonlinear ways, like style and approach. Barack Obama was a departure from George Bush on policy for sure, but he also was a sharp departure from George Bush
in style.
There's no one who represents a sharper departure from Barack Obama.
In other words, that's that famous night. Maybe you were there. You probably were there. White House Correspondents' Dinner, and president gets up and just tears Donald Trump's head off. And I was I'm a table away for my sins. And there you could see steam, at least metaphorically, rising off the shoulders and an orange head of Donald Trump. And now a lot of people think, that's the creation myth. That's the moment that Donald Trump decided, I am going to get back at this son of a bitch.
I have to tell you that I don't think that Donald Trump's ambitions, needed Stoking. Any torquing up. I think that he'd been talking about running for president, you know, for years.
You think that was a joke, a kind of marketing exercise?
Well, I don't know. I can't climb into the head of Donald Trump. But the point is, it wasn't a new ambition for him. And I think he found in the birther movement the reaction he got was something that encouraged him to think that he could pull this off. He got a feel for the wrath that was out there that he could exploit.
I remember interviewing the president about race years ago. You were still in the White House, and the discussion was interesting, but there was a formality to it.
Yes.
And then it ended, and then the president went down the hall, and then he turned around, and he came back, and he said, look, I got to tell you, discussing these things is really complicated. This is years ago. Really difficult. I say a stray word, and it moves markets, as it were.
In the same
way that you can affect the stock market with a stray word. Years have gone by now. We've seen one horrible incident after another, and the incidents obviously paint a picture that these are not incidents. This is a pattern. This is a way of life, in terms of what it is to be African-American in this country. And the president's language about this has evolved, and yet he's going to leave office, I think, on these issues with a deep sense of pain and ambivalence, as well as some sense of historical accomplishment. How do you view it?
Well, first of all, you get this question all the time, are we worse off now? And the answer is no, we're not worse off. We're just having a more honest discussion. David, when I was a young journalist, one of my first jobs was as a political columnist at the Hyde Park Herald. I was 18 years old when I started writing political columns there. The first column I ever wrote in Chicago in December of 1973 was about the clash between Mayor Richard J. Daley and Ralph Metcalf, who was a congressman on the south side of Chicago, over police brutality. And it was a defining issue of that time. The difference today is that everyone has a cell phone, and now all of America can see what the experience of African Americans has been for generations. That doesn't mean that the problem is worse. It means that we now are more focused on it because people can see it, and it's out in the open. And in certain ways, having the first African American president has surfaced some things that have always been there, because race has been central to our story in a very painful way from the beginning of the Republic. So I don't think that, you know, our problems are worse, but our problems are more evident.
But tell me from the inside, as a confidant of the president, somebody really close to him, about how he approached talking about this from the start. Because it begins, in a sense, with he wanted to make a race speech long before he made it.
Right.
And people around him, maybe
you,
were very reluctant to have this speech made.
Because he was running for president of the United States.
And I think the line was from the campaign, they already know you're black.
Right.
In other words, you don't need to make a race speech. And it was a speech born of necessity and Jeremiah Wright and all the rest.
Exactly.
Tell me about his thinking, and as you see it, on the evolution.
I think that there are a couple of things. One is, the moment at which we arrived at the White House, we didn't have sort of options about how to prioritize how he would spend his political capital because we had an epic crisis, a serial crisis. That had to be the focus. The second thing was he was always conscious, we were always conscious of he was always an African-American man who is running for president of the United States, not a man running to be the first black president. He didn't want to be limited that way. But, you know, I saw things happen that would not have happened to another president. No other president would have had his very citizenship questioned in the way it was. No other president would have had a member of Congress stand up and shout, "You lie," in the chambers. Through all the vituperative history of the Republic, we've never seen that until now. So obviously, race has been part of the story, but we never wanted to be in a position where it appeared as if he was saying, I should be treated differently, even though he was being treated differently. We didn't want to look like we were creating excuses for what people perceived as shortcomings in our administration, saying I should be judged differently. I mean, and it was a very difficult line to walk, and at times an untenable line to walk.
Do you think he becomes an ex-president on January 20th?
Yes.
And probably one of the first things he'll do is sign a book contract and begin to write it.
I think so, yeah.
Do you think that we will ever really know the full extent of what it's like to be that guy, the feeling when it comes to moments like
this? I hope so. You know,
because those books are generally terrible and stinting.
Well, I will tell you that I expect that he's going to write one of the great presidential autobiographies ever, because he is a writer. And one of the things that I've always noticed about him is that he's always in the scene but watching the scene. He's very observant about people. And, you saw in Dreams from My Father that he has the ability also through his writing to probe himself. And I expect that he will confront those issues in his book, and we'll learn what it was like to be him, essentially the Jackie Robinson of politics, as it were, breaking this barrier and the pressures that were associated with that. But I just have to say, I have to take a moment just to say how proud I am of how he's conducted himself. I don't think anybody's, probably since Roosevelt, had experienced quite a term or two terms like this, given what we confronted coming in. And you add this element that we're talking about, and the fact that he's been a real role model, and I don't mean just for African Americans, but for the whole country and his family as well. Quite apart from everything that he's achieved, he's an admirable human being, and I think people have come to that conclusion.
David, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Good to see you. David Axelrod. He's the director of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. Ahead this hour, it's organic, it's gluten-free, and it will turn you into a superhuman.
On my way home, I stopped at a nearby children's hospital and cured every child with a dropper full of coconut oil. It was so nice and so easy.
Miracles on the cheap. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Scirocco Dunlap is a writer and performer, and she's got a few words for us about the miraculous benefits, the truly miraculous benefits, of coconut oil.
Coconut oil changed my life, and also my genetic coding. I had heard that coconut oil was a natural wonder, and I'm all for anything that doesn't contain gluten, but I couldn't have known how big an impact this little oil would have on me. One night, while simultaneously drinking and bathing in a vat of coconut oil, I opened my eyes. What do you think happened? Did coconut oil get in my eyes? Yes. Was it extremely painful? Yes, again. Did it make my vision superhuman? You nailed it. Within seconds, I was able to see three galaxies away to a planet named Gehen. A few dabs of coconut oil in my ears, and I could hear the ghosts of all my ancestors.
"You're fabulous,"
they whispered.
"The triumph of our bloodline."
Can you believe that I got this stuff at Trader Joe's? When I finally climbed out of the vat, it barely came as a surprise that my sense of time was no longer linear. I could see the past and the future. And the future looked grim, friends. There I was, a few weeks older, and on a bad date. Fortunately, my powers were still growing, and I was developing a beta form of completely organic, sulfate-free mind control. So I stepped forward in time and implanted the idea in that man's mind to swipe left on my Tinder profile. But don't worry, ladies, I also made him immediately regret it. On my way home, I stopped at a nearby children's hospital and cured every child with a dropper full of coconut oil. It was so nice and so easy. I'm confused why people don't do this more often. Probably because of Monsanto. Wanting to get just a little bit more out of the coconut oil that was now swimming through my synaptic gaps, I thought, hey, why not inject this like heroin? I'm no stranger to the dragon, but that addiction has been cured. With heaping spoonfuls of coconut oil, of course. So into my veins the oil went. Within seconds, I mind-melded with every being in the multiverse. I am everyone and everything, and my power and ability go beyond anything you know. I am the spoon. No, that's absurd. I am the biodegradable spoon. Now, as my atoms float through the galaxy, I ponder existence with the knowledge of all that's ever been, and consider the benefits I've received from going natural. Life can be so amazing when you aren't restricted by advertisers, big business, or physics. All in all, I highly recommend buying a jar of coconut oil and getting all these benefits for yourself. Don't put that on your face, though, because you'll break out like crazy.
The miraculous benefits of coconut oil. Please ask your doctor before you use it, okay? We're not giving out medical advice here. It's just a story, and it's written and performed by Scirocco Dunlap. You can find all her pieces for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. Now, our next story is about a mathematician, and before you go, I got a C minus in math, just hold on a second, because Kathy O'Neill's work is important to you, to me, to all of us. She's written a book called Weapons of Math Destruction. O'Neill's book is about algorithms, the complicated rules that programmers feed into computers and that increasingly make decisions about our lives. As O'Neill tells it, This is very dangerous, and we don't even know it's happening. The New Yorker's Sheila Kohatkar went to talk with her, and she picked a Sunday night, which is the very best time to visit Kathy O'Neill. When she's not trying to save us from enslavement to bad math, Kathy plays bluegrass. And on Sunday nights, her band comes over for dinner and practice.
So there were seven or eight of them around the coffee table. There were a couple of musicians with guitars, I would say three or four. There was one with a mandolin. Kathy was there with her fiddle. And their typical routine was to kind of go around in a circle, and every person got to choose one or two songs that they wanted to do. And then they just bust it out. Band was sort of wailing away in the other room, and then Kathy was preparing the filler for these burritos. So she was standing over a gas oven, and she fried up a bunch of pinto beans. She dumped in an enormous mountain of cheese.
Hey, Yohan, will you tell the kids that the burritos are ready? Thank you. That's my husband, by the way.
And then she stirred in salsa, and she said, well, this is an amazing recipe because you can basically add in any proportion of any of these ingredients, and it'll be delicious.
And then mix it in. It's nice and creamy. And this is done, too.
Are you too distracted to tell us about how you came to the decision to write the book? Like,
no,
why did you decide?
I'll back up a little bit. I was in finance and
at this hedge fund, which was called DE Shaw. It's a huge fund. She was there to design programs that the hedge fund could use to make money trading in the stock market.
And at some point, I was like, I went into finance thinking I was like making the market more efficient, but now I'm just like, I'm trying to take money from people saving for retirement. Like, that's how I. That's, and I just got my stomach just tied up in knots because I was like, I don't want this to work. I literally got to the point where I'm like, everyone I work with wants to prove that their models are making big, big profits because they can get a piece of it. And I literally want mine to fail.
Well, one of the reasons she felt that, you know, she could really see a lot of what was going on in the financial world at the time she's working at this hedge fund was because she was really different. She had a different worldview.
Partly because I'm a woman. Partly because, like, I'm a fat woman. I'm a little bit unusual enough so that I can see the system, but I can also see the extent to which the system isn't for me. And then I can question, like, why is this system so important to everyone?
So she left, and of course the Occupy Wall Street movement was rising up at this time.
So I started the alt banking group of Occupy. And then I started, you know, I was working in data science, and I kind of felt like, so I've never really said it this way, but I think it's true. Like, everybody knew that the financial crisis had happened, but what I was seeing was a kind of new crisis, like emerging in the world of big data.
You know, there are a lot of companies out there studying in detail what you do when you're on the internet, what websites you visit, how long you're there, how quickly you scroll up and down, what things you search for in Google, you know, what you like to buy, where you get your groceries. All of that is being sort of tracked and monitored and scooped up. By various companies and entities, by analyzing so much information, they can really create very sophisticated profiles of people. Ultimately, some of these profiles can become very harmful to people.
I saw a new kind of victim. I saw, like, individuals just getting screwed by sort of automated, unfair decisions. My friend was a principal, and her teachers were getting these terrible value-added teacher scores. And she couldn't explain them to me, and she couldn't explain them to her teachers. And I was like, what the heck is going on? You know. And then I looked into it, and it seemed very arbitrary and statistically non-robust. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to get the source code for the formula. And it turns out I couldn't. So then what I did was I found a friend of a friend who worked in the actual data company. Basically, said, how do I get the source code? And they said, oh, you're never going to get that. You're never going to get that. We have a contract with the city of New York that says that no one in the city of New York will ever get access to that. It's on the contract. Not even the Department of Education had access to that. And by the way, I should have mentioned that when my friend, the principal, asked asked for an explanation, she was told multiple times by people in the Department of Education, you wouldn't understand it because it's math. That's like the opposite of what mathematicians want to be true. We want mathematics to clarify. That was a weapon. It was weaponized mathematics.
Once you started to think about this, did you start to see this everywhere you looked? That's my impression.
I started to see it regularly. I wouldn't say everywhere I looked. I started learning about lots and lots of different industries where they were using weird kind of opaque but powerful models that would ruin people's lives and not be explained to them. And the strongest example, the one that kept me up at night, was like the recidivism risk model, which was like used by judges to decide how long prisoners should go to jail.
So the recidivism risk model is an algorithm that's used across the country in law enforcement to try to predict who is likely to become a repeat offender. So in order to determine the length of sentence to give to someone, you know, the judge will use a formula. Do they live in a poor or high crime part of the city? You know, do any of their family members have criminal records?
Which I was like, these are all proxies for race and class. And so if you are in the wrong race, in the wrong class, you're going to be scored higher. That has nothing to do with what you've actually done, you know, what your criminal acts were. It was sort of, a weaponized mathematical object. Hey, do you have a tortilla?
No.
Do you want some Nutella?
Yeah.
You can get it. I started seeing this as a, let me just grab the Nutella, sorry. Look at all the Nutellas we have in here, guys.
So in the middle of her talking to me about
real.
This, her son wandered into the kitchen asking for Nutella.
I wrote about him in my book as my child only eats Nutella. You haven't met my 14-year-old, but he is actually the most encouraging person in the world. And he's been telling me since I started that I'm going to write the best book that's ever been written and everyone's going to love it. So that's kind of important. There he is. Sonder, hi. He is like me, like someone who, when I was his age, I was like very sensitive, like very emotional. And if you don't start like feeling pain for other people when you're a teenager, then you're never going to start, as far as I could tell.
One of her bandmates, Jamie, said, you know, she had a very distinct memory of Kathy coming in to band practice one day and talking about this recidivism model. She had just sort of put all these pieces together and really seen what was going on in prison sentencing, and she was so upset and disturbed about it. And she reported to her bandmates that she hadn't been able to sleep the night before because she was so distraught.
My question, whenever I encounter someone who is building these models, is like, what about the people who get low scores? Do they feel like, is it fair that they got low scores? When you get more efficient, what happens to them?
So she realized that this model that she thought was really unfair, that was being used for prison sentencing, similar types of models were being used in all different areas of life. For example, determining people's credit card interest rates, determining who would get charged what for health insurance, figuring out who would qualify for a particular job or who could get a small business loan. All sorts of companies and even arms of the government were using algorithms that she realized were really biased to determine who would get what and who would pay what for the services they were getting. And all of this reminded her of the financial crisis, but it's not getting the same attention.
This is like a silent financial crisis. In the case of big data, there will be no explosion. It'll be a series of quiet failures and unfairnesses and tragedies, really. Because it's so like insidious, like the effects of algorithms are so embedded into our daily lives, and we often don't even know we're being scored. It means that we will be sifted and segregated and siloed into these marketing segments or these losers and winners categories, and we will, like, we, the winners, the technologists, the mathematicians, we will never see the losers. We will never consider them, and the world will never know what happened because everything is so secret. But it's an ongoing, gradual degradation of the quality of life of the people that we deem losers. Like, they deserve more thought than that. And they deserve better scoring systems and more fair scoring systems. And justice, for that matter.
Kathy said to me that the research for this book really made her depressed. It kept her up at night. And playing music with her band every week was a real form of escape.
Cheers.
Love you guys.
And she kept saying, they're like therapy. I couldn't have done it without them. They're like my therapists.
The New Yorker Sheila Kolhatkar talking with Kathy O'Neill, the author of Weapons of Math Destruction. That's her with the Tomtown Ramblers. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. There's much more to come. I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Tammy Kim is a fact checker at The New Yorker, and usually I go wandering over there to see how things are going, but Tammy's dropped by today. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And I wanted to see what was on your mind, what you're reading, what you're listening to, what you're watching.
I brought a few splendid items today. The first one is the most recent album by Slater Kinney, which I think has been in the magazine in the past. Slater Kinney is a band from my neck of the woods in Washington State.
Thank God, finally a band that I know. Usually somebody comes by and it's something that just came out 10 minutes ago.
Right. I'm not that cool. But I grew up with this band, and their new album is phenomenal. And the first song on the album is incredible. It's called Price Tag. And it's my line that this is the song for millennials. It is a song about the new economy and all of its failed promises.
I saw them live not so long ago, and they were fantastic.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, yeah. So I know you've also been reading a lot, and the book that you're into now is?
Human Acts, which is the second novel in translation by Hangang, who is a Korean novelist and short story writer. This book, Human Acts, is a very dark tale told from multiple perspectives about the Gwangju Massacre, which was a massacre of civilians in 1980 in South Korea during the democracy movement. It's quite beautifully translated by Deborah Smith. It is notoriously difficult to translate from the Korean, so I'm really grateful that
Why
it's been getting
some
play. Why is that
the case, more than most?
So I grew up with Korean and English in the home. Korean has actually the same grammatical structure as Japanese, but I think for reasons of history, it's not being really accessed by the West. And then it's also just a very difficult language to learn for Westerners. It's always classified as one of the hardest languages to learn.
And what else have you got for us?
Well, David, you and I have discussed Korean food before. And of course, there are the Korean superstar celebrity chefs like David Chang and Hoonie Kim and Roy Choi. But have you heard of Mangchi?
I'm going to right now.
Mangchi is a middle-aged Korean woman who does these sort of homemade recipes that aren't particularly fantastic, but speak to this wonderful sort of mundaneness and ordinariness of Korean food and how it can be practiced in an everyday setting.
What does that mean, mundane Korean food? You're making it, you're not giving a hard sell here.
Well, I think it's fabulous. But of course, I grew up in a time where it was considered much more exotic and weird and pungent. And so what I like about her is that she's somewhere in this kind of middle zone of, oh, it's not weird and disgusting, but it's also not this sort of haute cuisine
that
is difficult
to access.
So what is she cooking? What's she making? I was looking back, and quite a few years ago, she made this recipe for tteokbokki, which is a spicy rice cake. It's a kind of street food, but it's been sort of hodified in some of the fancy restaurants lately. And then she reprised it this year and made a much more fancy video because she's more well-funded.
7 dried anchovies we need. Remove the heads and guts. Heads and guts inside. Just press this way. And take it out. We are going to use 7 dried anchovies.
Now, I watch these things to relax, and I don't cook worth a damn. Do you cook?
I do. I cook a lot.
And do you pick up a lot from her?
No, not at all.
Because you already know it.
Absolutely. My mom is way better.
The New Yorker's Tammy Kim. You can find her picks for music, books, and cooking at newyorkerradio.org. Now, Kenya Barris has a resume as a TV writer and producer going back 20 years. He was a creator of America's Next Top Model. But he came on the radar for most of us with Black-ish. When it premiered on ABC in 2014, it was the first major network show centered on the life of a black family in almost a decade. On the one hand, it's a classic sitcom, the bickering family, the middle-aged dad out of touch with his kids. You know the story. But the fun is in the execution. Now, Black-ish also does something we haven't really seen on a sitcom in a long time, which is to be totally open about the issues that black families in America face in real life. And Kenya Barris, like the best successful TV writers, gets a lot of his material from his own life. So, Kenya, welcome. And I wanted to first begin by getting a sense of the origins of the show. How is Black-ish your story?
Well, it really happened. My wife's name is Rainbow. She's a biracial anesthesiologist, you know, hippie kid. Her mom was a hypnotherapist, and they kind of were, they grew up, like, differently than I did. And my mom was, you know, sort of a self-made, bootstrapping kind of hustler from the hood along with my dad. So we kind of came from the hood. My wife came from different places, but we both came from definitely meager financial beginnings. And I looked up at the version of what I remember being a little black kid was, and that's not the kids that I was raising. They were sort of a hybrid, watered-down version of what my notion of being a black kid were. They were sort of black-ish in that way. But then I looked at all their friends who were mostly because of the schools and things that, you know, my wife's now a doctor and I'm a writer at the time. You know, the schools that they were going to, a lot of their kids were not African-American. They weren't, you know, completely white kids. They had a little black in all of them. So they were sort of black-ish. And I realized that youth culture was this homogenization of everything. You know what I'm saying? It was like they were all black-ish. And I felt like I started feeling like a dinosaur myself, and that's where the character of Dre came from. You know, we've all been taught to give your kids more than you've got, than you had. But in doing that, what do they lose in the sort of transition? And that's sort of what the conceit of the show was.
Did the title come right away? Because the title is genius, and I know some people have objected to it, and they made a little anxious by it, but it's just as good a title as The Honeymooners.
Yeah, I mean, I really love the title. The other title that I liked was Black is the New Black. and, you know, I threw out Black-ish to the network and studio, and they kind of raised their eyebrows, and, you know, they got it, and they laughed, but they were like, when the show launched, it really was like, oh, my God, is this going to be the end of me? Is this going to be the thing that, and people did respond negatively to it. A lot of people did respond negatively.
Who exactly? Was there a type of person that responded negatively?
A lot of people in the black community in particular. Donald Trump didn't actually like the name of the show. He actually tweeted about it. But,
have disappointed you immensely.
Yes, I was so sad. I think a lot of white people felt like, well, the thing I heard from white people was, if we named a show Whitish, that would be so racist. And, you know, my response to that is the show name Whitish is Friends, you know what I'm saying, or is Seinfeld. And I think black people that responded to it felt like so often we had been duped with, you know, a promise of something that delivered something that was coonish or a complete stereotype. And they felt like, here it is. And the thing that I told people is that I could have named it the Johnsons or New in Town or whatever, but I felt like I wanted you to know when you sat down that you were seeing something that you had not seen before.
So season three just premiered, and the first episode is about a family trip to Disneyland, and Dre goes and buys the whole family VIP passes, which is a great bougie move. But,
right.
But then the passes expire, and the kids complain, and the whole trip loses its allure for a moment. Let's listen to a clip from it.
Most people die climbing Everest. We're going to die waiting to ride it.
I hate my life right now.
I hate my dad right now.
Are you kidding me? Huh? You wait in one line and you have a meltdown? You had an incredible day. You got to ride like 20 rides in 10 minutes. You got to go ahead of Green Day. Did you see the puss on Trey Cool? Huh? And you know what's worse? Not one person has even said thank you.
Gee, thanks, Dad.
Shut up! Not sincere. You monsters are dead to me!
That actually happened to me.
You poor thing.
I know. It happened to me, not in that aspect. I mean, growing up, going into Disneyland for me was like, I might as well have gone to Paris because it was such a... You know, it was such an expense, you know, and my parents made a big deal of it. And when I went, you know, a few years ago, I took my kids to Disneyland and trying to sort of give them more than I had, I got, you know, I was like, I really want to go. And I got caught up in the moment. I really want to go all out. So I went and got, they have these tour guides, and I got the tour guides. And tour guides are an arm and a leg, but they walk you around the park, and you can go to the front of most lines.
Are the tour guides dressed as Snow White and Dumbo and all that?
No, they're dressed just as, they're dressed like in a plaid sort of, they're dressed as, it called cast members, Disney cast, like a plaid vest with a blue tie, and they look very...
Disturbing.
But they would walk us up to the lines, and like, we went on like 10 rides, and then one, you know, we got to like Pirates of the Caribbean, and they're like, this one we can't do for whatever reason. And my kids, it had been like an hour and a half, and my kids, the first time they've ever had this experience, are like, oh, we have to wait. And I lost my mind. I was like, this is not real life. This is not real life. Like, and I realized that this was my fault, that I had put them into this. I had taken away what Disneyland was about. Disneyland was about waiting in the lines. Disneyland is about family. Disneyland is about being together. And I had made it about, you know, the VIP experience and taken, and I was like, this was a real lesson for me.
So it was your own damn fault.
Absolutely, 100%.
Well, maybe they'll forgive you one day.
I don't care if they do or not.
You recently told a reporter that you don't want to talk about diversity anymore. Mm-hmm. Why not? You're just on too many panels, or are we in a place where we don't need to have these conversations anymore?
No, in this particular, like a situation like this, I wouldn't mind talking about it. And I wouldn't mind talking about it in general. But it was... our fourth TCA, because we did one for the pilot, it was our fourth TCA.
TCA.
And it was the Television Critics Association,
okay.
You know, event. And we, you know, were coming out, and it was like, I was so happy because it was a year we had got nominated for an Emmy. We had had a lot, you know, a lot of people had said really good things about the show. People knew the characters now. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this reporter started to ask questions about what's the demographic in this. And I was like, none of this has anything to do with the show. Like, can you talk about, no one had talked about the Emmy nominations, the great work that the actors had done, the great directing work that had been done, the writing work that had been done. And I kind of lost it. I kind of was embarrassed. But I felt like this to me is clouding the narrative when you start mm-hmm. to only want to talk about the niche thing and not the work being done. And I know people are like, well, how are you going to say that you have a show called Blackish? That doesn't mean that for the rest of the show, that's all I want to talk about. Like that, oh my God, they're just like us. They're black and they can write words and they understand the music syncs up to the lips and the sound works. I feel like at a certain point, let's talk about the actual work, because the next generation coming behind me wants to talk about the work too. I don't want to ever run away from the diversity conversation in general. I am proud to be sort of a part of that, you know, that pack that is in this diversity conversation, and I wouldn't be where I were today if it wasn't for diversity.
Do you feel the hot breath of the next generation behind you? Are you already starting to feel the impact on television of Blackish and things like it?
Without sounding, you know, in any way, shape, or form, like trying to sound arrogant, yeah, I think so. I think so. I think that there are things that feel derivative of the opportunity that ABC allowed us to do and the success that we've gotten. I think that there is the notion of like, oh, well, let's do this family and let's do that family and let's do this show. And let's have, you know, every voice now sort of feels like people now know that there is a place in the mainstream for unique voices.
Kenya, what credit do you think historically and in the moment does Shonda Rhimes, should she get for this forward movement in television?
The godmother.
Because the gap between ABC and its competitors on this question is, it seems to me, immense.
I feel in this particular time, I'll say Yvette Lee Bowser's the queen. She was the first African-American woman to have, or maybe African-American period, to have a network, primetime network television show. She's ran taken three different shows to syndication. She's now running Dear White People on Netflix. She worked with me for the last couple of years. She's a great, great writer. She was one of the first people to sort of break that into the mainstream in that way. And I think if she was the godmother, then Shonda's the queen, because she really, coined the word, I believe, almost in colorless casting. And, you know, I look at her and she's broken every single boundary there ever was.
Do you think the other networks and the other cable networks have gotten the hint?
Yes, I do. I think that cable is in a much better place, you know, in terms of perception than network. But I think the thing that I got from Shonda is that I still truly, truly, truly believe in network. I believe that ABC Studios and ABC Network have given me a mic to let the world sort of know that there is a different voice out there and doesn't have to be a watered-down voice. At the same time, we are able to reach 7, 8, 9, 10 million people sometime with our message. And there's still profit to our show. We still can actually form a profit base to do and become other things.
And in a way, the stakes are higher because of the number of people who are still watching the traditional networks. And you have an episode that Emily Nussbaum, in her profile of you in The New Yorker, and other critics too, have pointed out that there's a particular episode, it's called Hope, that maybe more than any episode on Blackish or any episode of anything on television took on race head on, and particularly the business of police brutality. Let's hear a clip first from Hope, which is an amazing episode of television.
The system is rigged against us.
Maybe it is, Dre, but I don't want to feel like my kids are living in a world that is so flawed that they can't have any hope.
Oh, so you want to talk about hope, Bo? Obama ran on hope. Remember when he got elected? And we felt like maybe, just maybe, we got out of that bad place and made it to a good place. That the whole country was really ready to turn the corner. You remember that amazing feeling we had during the inauguration? I was sitting right next to you. And we were so proud. And we saw him get out of that limo and walk alongside of it and wave to that crowd. Tell me you weren't terrified when you saw that. Tell me you weren't worried that someone was going to snatch that hope away from us like they always do.
Kenya, we're coming to the end of the Obama presidency. We may be even facing the possibility of a Trump presidency. And even if he loses to Hillary Clinton, Trumpism has unleashed talk and demagogy that we have not heard in this country on such a big stage in quite a long time. And where are you in your thinking about the Obama presidency and what's ahead for this issue and how it may affect Blackish?
I mean, it's going to affect the family and just our world in a monstrous way. We have an episode on voting this year that kind of deals with Dre lamenting the loss of Barack. The good thing that I feel like Donald Trump has brought about is that he has unearthed what was already there in this country, and it's the divisive nature of who we really truly are. People had thought, well, we had a black president, that we're past that, we're not. And I think that's the kind of thing that sometimes you need a little bit of a shakeup. And this goes to both sides, left and right. and black people and white people, I think the thing that we are not doing is we are not having communication. We're not talking. And there is a huge amount of conversations that need to be had still.
Kenya, thank you so much.
Thank you, man. This is awesome.
Writer and producer Kenya Barris, the creator of ABC's Black-ish. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we are done for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. Next week, I'm going to learn a few things about dance and theater from Mikhail Baryshnikov. That's next time. Till then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Alex Barron, Becky Cooper, Johnny Vince Evans, and Eric Malinsky. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
No, that's absurd. I am the biodegradable spoon. Yeah.